You're listening to The Point.
Lisa Genova, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.
All right, so your books focus on neurological diseases, and your previous books looked at Alzheimer's, brain injury, autism, and Huntington's disease. So how do you choose what disease you're going to highlight?
Sometimes it's personal, and sometimes it's a curiosity. This time, it was personal. Yeah. So one of the co-writers and co-directors of the film, Still Alice, his name was Richard Glatzer. He was diagnosed with ALS just a couple of months before he read Still Alice, and he and his husband, Wash, decided that they were going to take on this film project. And a remarkable decision, really, because with ALS, the average life expectancy following diagnosis is 3 years. And Richard had an aggressive form. It began in the motor neurons that feed the muscles of his head and neck first. So he lost the ability to speak right away. And so the choice was, you know, do we circle the wagons and spend time with family and friends? Do we sell the house and travel the world? Or do we want to make one more film? And so I got to know him really well. And I got to witness his grace and tenacity and courage and generosity on the set of that film. And then following it when we were sort of on tour with all the awards shows and helping support Julianne Moore in her bid for Oscar. And I asked him a couple of months after we finished shooting if I could write about ALS next in his honor. And he said, of course. And so the first person I came to know in terms of asking, what does it feel like to live with ALS, was Richard Glatzer.
And you never heard his voice.
No, not until his funeral. They played some audio from before he had ALS. And that's when I actually realized it. Like, oh, I welled up with emotion. Like, oh, my God, that's his voice. I've actually never heard him speak.
And I mean, you throughout the filming, I mean, I think towards the end there, he was just using a toe, right, to tap. I mean, this must have been so difficult for him to take on this task.
Well, right. So, well, on set, he was, he couldn't speak. He's wearing a bib because you end up drooling a lot when you have ALS. And one arm was paralyzed. He was typing with one finger on an iPad. And when I say he was directing that film, he really was. It wasn't just like, oh, well, he's sort of on the sidelines. It was 12 hours a day. He was really there and doing it. It was when we were communicating by email about ALS and what is it like that he was at that point, both arms were paralyzed and he was typing with his big toe. It was, you know, you think about anything that you do, like I'm coming here today to speak with you. And so I hoped to get a good night's sleep last night. I hope to look okay when I show up and see you. I hope to present myself well to the listeners. You want to be your best self. And here's Richard. It's the film of his life. And he has to show up so compromised. And he did. And I'm forever grateful to him and so impressed by who he was.
So a lot of people have heard of ALS and maybe have this sort of idea of what this disease is in their mind. So tell us, and we get this in the book, the realities of this disease, but tell for folks who don't know what ALS is, tell us what it is.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, millions of us dumped a bucket of ice water over our heads, right? So we did this for ALS. We're probably all conscious of those three letters because of that, but we dumped the bucket of ice water over our heads and then maybe we posted it to Facebook and then went and had lunch and did the very next thing. And you didn't actually have a chance to feel something about this, to really understand what it might be like to live and die with this disease. So ALS is a neurodegenerative disease. It attacks the motor neurons in your brain and spinal cord. And those are the neurons that feed all of the voluntary muscles in your body. So those are the neurons that allow you to wiggle your toe, use your hands, toilet yourself, speak, breathe. So eventually you won't be able to do any of those things. This disease does not stop. Start to become paralyzed in your hands, it will move from one hand to the next. It will move through your legs. It'll move up your head, and you won't be able to eventually, everyone eventually can't breathe. Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about Stephen Hawking, but well, that's the other thing. So if you did the ice bucket challenge, that's one level of awareness. The other is like, well, I'm aware of Stephen Hawking. He had ALS and he lived a really long time. He just died actually a week before my book came out in March. He was 76. And so, well, there's this sort of misconception in some ways that, well, you can live a really long time with ALS. And he was diagnosed when he was 21. It was expected he would only have a couple of years to live, like everyone else. He did live a bit longer than most. But then he had a tracheostomy surgery and was hooked up to 24/7 life support. So to live with ALS that long, he would have died 33 years ago had he not had this invasive intervention.
Yeah. So Every Note Played is your new book. And in this story, we have Richard, an accomplished concert pianist, and his wife, or I should say ex-wife, is also a professional. She's a piano teacher, but she can play very well. So it's kind of a cruel irony, isn't it, that this concert pianist, and it starts in his hands. And so he has just, what a transition here for him, and his life is all about his playing. That's who he is. So we get their stories in alternating chapters, and I'm wondering why you decided to do it that way.
Okay. Well, first, yeah, I am that mean of an author. I do horrible things to perfectly nice fictional people. So like Alice and Still Alice, right? You want to raise the stakes as high as possible whenever possible while still telling the truth under the imagined circumstances. So with Alice and Still Alice, she gets Alzheimer's. And so what did I do to her? I made her an elite intellectual. She's a Harvard professor. She thinks for a living. And what happens when she can no longer do that? Well, that's when we get this sort of crisis of the soul, or this identity of who am I now and how can I matter? Because we tend to place a lot of our worth on what we do and not on who we are. So with Richard, I made him a concert pianist for a couple of reasons. One, here's a disease that's going to paralyze you. And so his entire passion in life and reason is to be able to play and use his hands. So what will happen to this man when he can no longer be that? The other is ALS, you know, you become progressively paralyzed. So your world shrinks basically to the confines of a wheelchair and a bed eventually. So what if I made him a world-renowned pianist where his life is very global and he's on a world stage and that collapses to the confines of a room?
Let's talk about the relationship with his wife.
That was the other part of your question. Yeah,
the ex-wife.
The alternating chapters, yeah. So with ALS, sort of more so than anything else I've written about, it doesn't just happen to one person. And of course, with all of these diseases, it never happens to one person. It happens to everyone who loves that person. But with ALS, you need care partners. Like, you literally cannot feed yourself anymore. You literally cannot bathe and toilet yourself anymore. So you need people around you to help. It's very expensive to hire that. Like, if you end up with a tracheostomy surgery and go on vented life support, costs anywhere between $200,000 and $400,000 a year in private nursing. Most people, if they go that route, or even before that route, it's mom, or it's your spouse, or it's your kids. It's family who are rolling up their sleeves and doing this. And so I thought it was necessary to tell the story in those two points of view. So I didn't make it Richard's wife. I made it his ex-wife. There were many reasons for this. So here's this disease where there is no cure. And so while we can't cure Richard's pathology, the biology, the ALS, what in him might we be able to heal that isn't the disease? Mm. And so here, what if I gave him this broken relationship where there was so much left unrepaired, unsaid? That's the other thing. Here's this disease that will eventually rob you of your ability to speak, to communicate. And that's terrifying to all of us.
Oh, sure.
But how many of us in our lives, perfectly capable of saying anything we want, leave things unsaid? We don't apologize. We don't say, I forgive you. We don't say, I love you. So maybe I could give these two people an opportunity for some healing before Richard goes.
Regret and forgiveness.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what this. Well, and it's interesting because we get her struggle as well as his, which are very different. And then also, you know, you're mentioning caregivers, and I'm wondering about Richard's relationship with Bill.
Yeah. Bill is everyone's favorite character.
We love Bill.
God bless Bill. So Bill is the home health aide. And so I came to know 12 people living with ALS in the course of writing this story. And 8 of the 12 died before I finished the final draft. In the course of knowing them, it was a combination of family caregivers and home health aides. And I was really struck by the love and care and commitment and tenderness of the home health aides. These are folks who have, you know, no, you know, DNA blood bond to the folks they're taking care of. And just the heart and just remarkable kindness of these folks. I was struck by it over and over again. Yeah. And so this story has a lot of darkness. Karina and Richard, the two main characters, you know, have a lot of struggle in addition to the ALS, and they're trying to find their way. Bill provided provided moments of levity and love, and he's very funny. And the book really is about care. Mm-hmm. It's about the ALS care clinic and what's provided, what they define as care. And it's Karina and Richard, and do they care about each other and their daughter, and how do they care for each other? Are they careless with each other? Mm-hmm. And then there's Bill, who's like the epitome of what care and love can look like.
Yeah. And I love that Bill likes show tunes. Richard does not.
No. Richard is a quintessential classical pianist. He loves Beethoven and Chopin. And here we've got Bill, who's, you know, singing all the songs from Hamilton, mm-hmm. and driving poor Richard nuts. But this is the man who cares for him, so Richard puts up with it.
And we should talk about Richard is classically trained, typical, as you say, but Karina is really more interested in jazz, which is also something Richard does not care for.
Right. So Karina, they met in college. They went to Curtis, and that's where they fell in love and everything started. And she was actually sort of on a trajectory to be more successful than Richard in classical piano. But she fell in love with jazz and decided to pursue that authentic love instead. And they started out in New York City, and her career had some footing. But then he got a position at New England Conservatory in Boston and decided to take it. And she assumed there would be a jazz career for her in Boston. She's originally from Poland. And there wasn't really anything in Boston for jazz. It's a very transitory place in Boston. You don't live here if you're a jazz musician. And so she unexpectedly became pregnant and became a mother. And her career just stopped. And interestingly, a lot of this book is about, so what's her story? So, you know, here we have Richard, who's paralyzed because of ALS. But on the other side, we have Karina, who's paralyzed in an emotional way. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us can relate to that. She's stuck in the past. She's got a lot of excuses and fear and blame around why she isn't living the life that she wants to live. And she's not doing anything about it other than sort of kind of there's
stewing.
Some
stewing.
She's stewing. There's some. Yeah, it's sort of familiar to her. And she kind of likes being right about it all rather than happy. And so, yeah, part of her journey is learning how to step out of that prison of her own making.
Yeah, and I have to say, I was like, why she's the ex-wife? Why does she have to go take care of him? But she does. She does. And there's a lot of reasons. If you read the book, you understand why she does that. But
yeah, she's a better woman than I.
Yeah, right.
But there are people who do this. It is fiction. And I did make this decision, which is somewhat extraordinary, that an ex-wife would take her ex-husband in. I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen with respect to Alzheimer's, Huntington's, and now with ALS.
And then, of course, we have the daughter's reaction to all of this. And she has a tough time with this, as you would.
Yeah, so Grace is fresh. She's just finishing up her freshman year in college. And actually, she's in her sophomore year when her parents reveal what's going on. And she's had a very distant relationship with her father because he was on this global stage, very busy traveling. And there's some betrayals sort of on both sides with Richard and Karina. Again, that nothing is black and white. There's always shades of gray. But as a, you know, 19-year-old, you have your very black and white perspective. And so her journey is to sort of come to see her father as a human, right, who is flawed like all of us, and to get to some resolution and some peace with him before he goes.
Something I don't know you would think about unless you were in a situation like this is the legacy messages. Talk about legacy messages. I thought this was fascinating.
Yeah. So I met this great guy named John Costello. He is out of Boston Children's, and he is an augmentative communications specialist. So he helps folks who are having anything compromising their ability to speak. He's got all these gadgets and high-tech devices and low-tech devices. And really, he's got this whole sort of, you know, toy box full of tools that you can use to try and communicate as your natural abilities are waning. And he loves what he does. And he's really passionate and excited about his ability to help you in any way that he can. And one of the things he offers is exactly what's in the book, which is the ability to record messages that will then be spoken. So if you've heard Stephen Hawking speak, it's that computer-generated voice. And so to have that as representing your voice, it's not you. It's very flat and lacks sort of the melody and the musicality of voice. And so I thought this would also be intriguing to Richard, for someone who loves music and sound and composition and the meaning that notes can convey, that maybe he would want to retain his voice while he still can and record it. And so folks can record things like thank you and can I please have a glass of water, or can you help me get to the bathroom? They can record these sort of activities of daily living messages. And then in addition to that, there are these things called that John calls legacy messages, which is the ability to say something really meaningful to the people you love that you're going to eventually leave behind. And sort of this idea of, what do you want people to know? What do you want to leave with them? What's your legacy? Hmm. And so Richard spends some time with this, because unlike the other diseases I've written about that are neurodegenerative and fatal with no cure, so we've got Alzheimer's and Huntington's, those diseases can take 7, 10, 20 years to play out. Mm-hmm. ALS is so fast for most people that it's really, you know, mortality and death, facing your own death, really does take center stage. And these were the conversations I was having with people really immediately. I'd come to know someone, and within the first day of knowing them, we're talking about like what their death might look like. Mm-hmm. And so it's this idea of legacy is really prominent for folks with ALS. What am I going to leave behind? What do I want the people I love to know?
And we should, it's fiction, but it's factual, based on factual. Everything you write about the disease is factual.
Always.
And that's your neuroscientist brain that's turning this fact in with the fiction.
Right. Yeah. And so, right. So if I want, so my background's in neuroscience. I've got the PhD in Harvard, and I used to do brain research. And so if I wanted to write about ALS for the Journal of Neuroscience, you're not going to read that. And the people who would read that, the information would tend to stay very intellectual. It would be knowledge. It would be sort of like knowing about the ice bucket challenge. Like, that's a fact. But if I want you to feel something, that's why I write fiction. But I need to do it in a way that's respectful and honors and portrays the people who have this accurately. And my books get used in medical school, nursing school, OT, PT, mm-hmm. speech. Like, I got to get the facts right.
Yeah.
So I feel an enormous responsibility for the people who go through this, so that they know that their story is being represented accurately and honestly. And then for the folks who don't know anything about ALS beyond the ice buckets, that this is their chance to actually know something real about it.
Right.
But it's wrapped in a story, because we human beings, that's where we get to empathy. Mm-hmm. That's how we walk in someone else's shoes, is through story.
Right. And this can happen at any age.
Yes. So that was stunning to see, too. So I met, you know, a couple of men in their 20s. One was at Yale Medical School. Another one was a triathlete who just got married in their 20s, diagnosed ALS. Several people in their 40s. My dear friend, Kevin Gosnell, I met him through this book, but we became very close. He's my age, and he mm-hmm. was diagnosed in May. I met him in September, and he died the following August.
Wow.
And then the oldest gentleman that I met, most of the people I met were men. The stats are, it's 60% men, 40% women. In my experience, it was more men than that. Chris Connors, who is, I believe, 65, I met him a week after he was diagnosed. Remarkable man. He'd been a Navy SEAL. If you're interested in the best obituary you'll ever read, Google Chris Connors ALS.
Mm. And so you do a lot of research before you sit down to write the book. And you mentioned twelve people you took that with the disease. So how long does the research take before you actually sit down to write the book?
It depends. It's usually 4 to 6 months before I ever start writing anything, and then it continues as I write the book. This one was a little longer. I shadowed neurologists and nurses at the ALS clinic at Mass General. I talked to the folks at ALS TDI in Cambridge. This is the only nonprofit biotech in the world, and it's exclusively focused on ALS. Mm-hmm. And then I met Ron Hoffman of Compassionate Care ALS, who I think you've interviewed at some point. If you haven't, you should. He's in Falmouth, and he is this amazing warrior angel hero for folks with ALS. So he will go to your house and bring you the equipment and care and wisdom that you and your family need as you're navigating this. Because it moves so fast, you don't even know what's next. It's mind-boggling to try and figure out what's happening to you as it's happening. And Ron's been doing this for 20 years, and he knows what's next. Yeah. And he does this with kindness and grace and compassion like nothing, no one and nothing else. I wish Ron existed for every disease out there. So I got in his car with him and traveled to people's homes on a regular basis.
So has Bill got a little bit of Ron in him?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
And I think we've talked about this before. You like to write at Starbucks. You've got your chair that you like to sit in. And now that people know that, do they walk in and go, oh, there's Lisa. Don't bother her. She's working.
Yeah, sometimes they do that, but sometimes they bother me too, which is okay. It's always fun to say hello to people. It's you know, it's summer now, though. I don't typically write there in the summers because
it's too busy.
You can't find a seat.
And you want your seat.
And I want my seat.
All right. The book is Every Note Played. Lisa Genova, always great to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Such a pleasure, Mindy. Thank you.
Coming up after break, we talk with author Brian Engels about his debut novel, Wild Ball.